Soviet nostalgia in Russia today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. 100 years ago, the revolution began that remade Russia into the Soviet Union. Now the Soviet Union is gone, but the mummified corpse of the man at the center of the revolution, Vladimir Lenin, still lies on display in Red Square.
Russia still doesn't know what to do with Lenin, just the way that Russia doesn't know what to do with its Soviet past and its Soviet legacy and what to replace it with.
And as President Trump heads to China, we look at President Xi's push to make his country a leader in clean energy, well, at least in China.
It is on track to export as many as 100 coal-fired power plants.
Those stories, plus how the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh suddenly became Saudi Club Fed. That's all today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you here this Tuesday. As a news show, you know the deal. We report the news, what's happening now. But sometimes understanding now also requires understanding then. And that's where we start today, exactly 100 years since the Russian Revolution. On this day in 1917, Vladimir Lenin and his Bolshevik comrades set in motion the revolutionary process that would eventually create the Soviet Union. In the heyday of the USSR, the date was observed as a high holiday, commemorated with lavish parades and pomp. But this year, not everyone is celebrating.
We have seen debates and shows and theater performances, films in Western capitals, in New York, in London, in Hong Kong. In Moscow, almost nothing.
That's Natalia Antalava in Tbilisi, the capital of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. She's the editor of Coda Story, an online news platform. Antalava says these days the Kremlin is confused about how to tell the story of the Bolshevik Revolution.
On one hand, of course, Vladimir Putin is the man who considers the collapse of the Soviet Union to be the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century.
Right.
That's his words. So you would think he would think of the creation of the Soviet Union as a good thing. But at the same time, commemoration puts him into a bit of a difficult position because encouraging protests and revolutions is not what the Kremlin wants to do. And of course, at the same time, there is the Orthodox Church. And Kremlin has very, very tight, close relationship with the Orthodox Church. And the church today disapproves of what happened in 1917.
Yeah, Putin is warning about divisions, but the country is very divided on how to commemorate 1917. What are the different camps?
Of course, it's a big country. It's a diverse country. It's a country of people with many opinions. So just because the Kremlin hasn't commemorated 1917 doesn't mean that no one else has.
Right.
There have been some exhibitions. The Hermitage had a big exhibition. There have also been some interesting projects from activists and historians and so on.
Let's get to some of the people you spoke with, because there's a big question of how this anniversary is being seen by the former Soviet republics. And you asked one man, a citizen of the Republic of Georgia, if the revolution had failed, what would your country be like today? Let's hear that. All right, Natalia, I'm told that he said the Russian Revolution set Georgia back 100 years. What else did he say?
He said we were in the process of building a very modern state, and this threw us back, and it ended the dreams that we have of having a modern progressive state. And this is a sentiment that's shared not just among the Georgians, but elsewhere in the Caucasus as well, because when the Bolshevik Revolution threw Russia into chaos and ended the Russian Empire, it also freed places like Georgia and Azerbaijan from being part of the Russian Empire. And there was a great deal of hope that, you know, this would become modern European states. And a lot of people that we spoke to, not just in Georgia, but also in Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan, for example, said, oh, you know, that was our chance of being colonized by the British, because, of course, the British sent, you know, had troops stationed in the Caucasus.
Is there anything to suggest that Lenin has fans in the Russia of 2017?
Just the fact that the body of Lenin all these years on is still lying on display on the Red Square indicates that they can't get rid of him. There've been a constant conversation about burying him, but the mummy's there. The people still queue up, not as much as they used to during the Soviet days when, you know, the entire schools would be bussed in to pay respects to the waxy mummy of Vladimir Lenin. But he's still there. Russia still doesn't know what to do with Lenin, just the way that Russia doesn't know what to do with its Soviet past and its Soviet legacy and what to replace it with. And I think Russians would actually quite like to move on, but without a proper digestion and debate and understanding of their past, it's very difficult to move on. And this anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the revolution, shows that how far Russia is from a healthy debate about its past.
That was Natalia Antalava in Georgia's capital, Tbilisi. She's the editor of the online news platform Coda Story. The Soviet Union and the Cold War may have ended, but Russia's influence still looms large in the region, and so does the shadow of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. That's why a plan in Belarus to build a nuclear reactor, funded by the Russian government, has Lithuania on edge. Reed Standish is a reporter who covered this for Foreign Policy. He says the new power plant is being built in Ostrovets, just 12 miles across the border from Lithuania.
They have a combination of environmental concerns. This is a region that's still scarred by the memory of Chernobyl in 1986. There's also the safety concerns. The Lithuanian government has expressed that there's some lax standards on the Belarus plant, and there's been some accidents in the past that have made them worry that this could lead to another nuclear incident. And then on top of all of that, there's these geopolitical concerns. This reactor is getting built by Belarus, but it's funded by the Russian government through its state-owned energy conglomerate known as Rosatom, which does nuclear energy. So this has them very concerned that there's some ulterior motive to this plant and that Russia might be wanting to sell cheap electricity into the European Union energy market and in that way have another sort of political tool in order to push on these countries that are trying to get out of Moscow's orbit.
So that's a healthy list of concerns there, environment, safety, and politics. Let's start with the environment. I mean, as you said, Chernobyl happened in 1986. That was just 30 miles from Lithuania. How fresh are those memories, and what are Lithuanian officials worried about?
There's a river that runs very close to the reactor that goes from Belarus into Lithuania. And so there's concerns that there could be nuclear runoff from that. A lot of their concerns stem from a lack of transparency with Belarus. You know, the Lithuanian government is very outspoken against the current government in Belarus run by Alexander Lukashenko, who's been in power for a very long time. They don't really take the government in Minsk at its word. So when Minsk says that it's complying by all the proper international nuclear regulations, you know, they want to see more evidence.
What kind of influence does Russia have in Lithuania right now?
Lithuania has to import about 2/3 of its electricity. So it knows that it's in a position where it could potentially get put over the barrel, so to speak. The Kremlin did similar things with natural gas to Ukraine twice in the 2000s, and it actually impeded the flow of natural gas into Lithuania right in the heart of winter. So when it's come to oil and natural gas, Lithuania has been moving very quickly to try and wean itself off Russian control. But when we get to the issue of electricity, they've been quite a bit further behind, and I think that's where a lot of this anxiety is coming from.
It sounds like what you're saying, though, Reed, is that this nuclear plant is symbolic of just a general concern in Lithuania, that the Kremlin is always trying to expand its sphere of influence.
Yeah, the Lithuanian government is probably one of the most outspoken governments against the Kremlin, especially since the annexation of Crimea and the outbreak of war in Ukraine in 2014. Again, the Lithuanian concerns for this kind of thing are that the Belarusians can't be taken at their word. And a lot of that distrust is in the politics of all of this. You know, Lithuania was the first country to declare independence from the Soviet Union, and it has a deep-seated suspicion of Moscow and, by association, Belarus, because it sees Belarus as a client state of the Kremlin.
You know, Reed, there's a lot of talk these days about Russian interference in the U.S. political process, but it's striking to have you remind us that some of these countries on the eastern border with Russia have been wary of Moscow for years. Would you say this is old news for countries like Lithuania?
They definitely say it's old news. When I was there speaking with senior people within the government, this is something I would always ask about, you know, what do you think of what's happening in Washington with alleged interference in the election? And they would say, this is nothing new to us. This has been the reality for us since the last 100 years even.
Yeah, old news, but still very relevant for Lithuanians. Reed Standish, a journalist based in Finland, thank you very much for explaining this.
Thanks for having me on.
Here's a bit of news you may have missed today. Syria has now said it intends to sign on to the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. That leaves the U.S. as the only nation now on record opposing the deal. I'm not sure if climate change will be on the agenda when President Trump meets China's Xi Jinping as part of the Asia tour. But whatever the case, China is doing a lot of talking about climate change all on its own. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
Chinese President Xi Jinping made big news around the world last month when he consolidated his power over his country at the 19th Communist Party Congress. What got fewer headlines was what Xi said about his country's role in fighting climate change.
Taking a driving seat in international cooperation to respond to climate change, China has become an important participant, contributor, and torchbearer in the global endeavor for ecological civilization.
That phrase, taking a driving seat, removed any doubt that China is positioning itself as the next global leader on the climate crisis. China was in the front seat, along with the U.S., in forging the breakthrough Paris Climate Agreement 2 years ago. But the U.S., under former President Obama, was driving the process. Now, with Obama's successor abandoning that leadership, China clearly sees a big opportunity. And it's moving fast. The country appears well ahead of its pollution target under the Paris Agreement. And even though it still burns more coal than any other country, it's working to wean itself off the dirty fuel. China canceled plans for more than 100 new coal-fired power plants this year alone.
I think that the country is certainly living up to President Xi's words domestically.
This is Andrew Light, a former U.S. climate negotiator.
In terms of their ambitious efforts to reduce their own emissions and to really lead the way.
China is also leading the way as the world's largest investor in renewable energy. But this effort isn't just about jockeying for position diplomatically or economically. It's also a response to pressures at home, where Chinese citizens are increasingly worried about their smog-choked cities.
If you look at Chinese society, they're going through what we had in the 60s and 70s.
This is former U.S. Acting Ambassador to China, David Rank.
Chinese political consciousness is evolving really around the environmental impacts that rapid development has had in China.
Domestic policy changes help President Xi's claim that his country is a climate leader, but
on the other hand, China is in many respects simply exporting its pollution.
Elizabeth Economy runs the Asia Studies program at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's talking about China's massive Belt and Road Initiative. It's a plan to invest nearly $1 trillion in infrastructure in nearly 70 countries, and it includes building lots of coal-fired power plants.
There's also going to be plans to export many other polluting industries. So part of China's commitment to addressing climate change must be a commitment to, you know, green the Belt and Road.
We are not likely to hear much about this from China this week. Presidents Trump and Xi aren't expected to talk about climate, but their meeting coincides with this year's Global Climate Summit in Germany. Countries there are shaping how the Paris Agreement works. And former U.S. negotiator Andrew Light says he'll be closely watching what China does there.
This is the test of Chinese leadership.
China long refused to allow other countries to verify its carbon pollution data. 2 years ago in Paris, it finally agreed to a verification system for all countries. Now, with the U.S. backing out of the agreement, Light says the question is whether China will stick to that commitment.
If China is really going to step into the leadership vacuum created by the United States, then they must also accept that other countries must be allowed to see what they're doing with respect to their emissions, because that is absolutely essential to get Paris to succeed.
Despite President Trump's announced withdrawal of the U.S. from the Paris Agreement, the U.S. is still in it for now, and it and China will be co-chairing the Working Group on Emissions Verification at the summit in Germany. Light says that is the room that he'll be watching to read the climate policy tea leaves this week, not the room where Presidents Trump and Xi are meeting. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Later on the show, we check into the five-star hotel that's become Saudi Arabia's version of Club Fed here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's check in with the Spanish region of Catalonia. Today, about 200 mayors from Catalonia gathered in Brussels. Their calls for liberty were a show of support for Carles Puigdemont. He was the president of Catalonia until he was deposed by Spain's central government for overseeing the region's push for independence. Now Puigdemont is in Brussels fighting extradition back to Spain. One of the mayors, Neus Lloveras Massana, said the Spanish government's crackdown during last month's independence referendum brought back bad memories.
The images of the police charges on October 1 reminded us of the worst times of police repression in our country.
Her reference was to repression under the dictatorship of General Francisco Franco. It was under Franco, right after Spain's Civil War, that another former Catalan leader was executed. His name was Luis Companys. My colleague Simon Watts dove into the BBC audio archives to help us remember him.
Born in 1882, Luis Companys lived through a turbulent time in Spanish and Catalan history. Initially a left-wing lawyer, Companys had two core beliefs. He thought Spain would only prosper if it became a modern country with a modern republican government, and he believed Catalonia should become its own self-governing state within a Spanish federation. Companys was elected regional president, and in 1934 he led a short-lived uprising against the right-wing government in Madrid. His independent Catalonia was crushed within 10 hours, and he was sentenced to decades in prison.
I guanyarem, guanyarem, perquè tenim un exèrcit modèlic amb organització.
2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. The Republicans, who controlled Barcelona, freed Companys and restored him to office. As Catalan regional president, he led the fight against General Franco's fascist forces, but also presided over a period of chaos in which anarchists and Republican extremists are thought to have killed several thousand people. Companys himself signed dozens of death sentences.
Un estado totalitario.
When General Franco and the fascists won the civil war, Luis Companys fled across the border to France. After the German invasion at the beginning of World War II, there was always the danger that Nazi forces would hand Companys over to their allies in Spain. In August 1940, the Gestapo came for him.
Dos homes vestits en civil y cuatro, amb uniforme de soldats alemanys.
2 men in civilian dress and 4 in German uniform came into the house with machine guns. They turned the house upside down. They also took all the documents they could find. Through all this, the soldiers were pointing their weapons at my husband as he sat in a chair. I had to take the civilians round with a revolver stuck in my back. When the operation was complete, the 4 soldiers took the president of Catalonia away into custody.
Carme Ballester found out that her husband was being held at the Nazi headquarters in a local chateau.
You can imagine how I felt at the time, alone, with only 10 centimes in my pocket. But I tried to be brave, and the next day I got my bike out and went to Chateau Caroline. I said I had a meeting with an officer, and I managed to look so confident that they waved me through. I saw a group of 4 soldiers with my husband in the middle. They were transferring him. I just cried out, Luis. He turned and gave me a get out of here signal with his hand. I never saw him again.
The Nazis handed Companys over to Franco. He was held in solitary confinement and tortured. And a few weeks later, he appeared before a military tribunal at Montjuic Castle. The Kangaroo Court sentenced the elected Catalan leader to death for crimes including resisting Franco's glorious crusade. This is what his sister, Ramona Companys, wrote in her diary.
Tota la tarda vaig estar esperant un passe per anar a Montjuïc.
I spent the whole afternoon waiting for a pass to go to Montjuïc Castle. Finally, at 8 p.m., his defense counsel told me the news was bad. I don't remember ever feeling such strong emotion.
No recordo haver sentit mai tan forta emoció.
By 10 p.m., I was at the castle. We were told we could only see my brother through a window, and he seemed to be writing. I was beside myself, because I wasn't being allowed to give my brother a last embrace. The commanding officer said he couldn't give permission, but I could go and ask a judge.
Ramona Companys' tearful testimony persuaded the judge to allow her and her sisters to enter their brother's cell for a final visit.
Pensa en tot.
He is still thinking about others. He asked us if we came in a taxi, and when he realized that the driver might have missed dinner, He remembered that he still had a lot of food left from the morning. He ended up preparing a little parcel for him. Then he said, he'll probably want some cigarettes too.
Jo, Lluís Companys Jové, trobant-me al castell de
Montjuïc. I, Lluís Companys, finding myself at Montjuïc Castle, facing a court-martial, certify that I have written this document.
This is the will of Lluís Companys, written the night before his execution.
A tots els que m'han agraviat, perdono.
I forgive all who have offended me, and I ask forgiveness from all whom I have offended. If I am to die, I will die calmly. There is not a single drop of bitterness within me. I will give thanks to God for allowing me the beauty of dying for my beliefs. My humble being could not hope for a more worthy end, to die for Catalonia and how it embodies peace, justice and love.
Per Catalunya i lo que representa de pau, justícia i amor.
Before dawn, two priests came to Lluís Companys' cell to say Mass. As a former altar boy, he even offered to help them with the service. Then, for his final request, Companys asked for bread with Catalan chocolate and a bottle of cognac. On the way to his death, Companys smoked cigarettes and chatted to the priests. Asked if he wanted a blindfold, he refused. Witnesses later said that the firing squad were visibly nervous and that Companys looked them in the eyes throughout his execution.
A les 9 hem anat a rebre el cadàver del meu germà al cementiri nou. Estava com ahir.
At 9 o'clock, we went to retrieve my brother's body. He looked the same as yesterday. He still had the same smile on his lips that I had seen a few hours before. There were some soldiers, guards, and other civilians there who I imagined were secret police. I held my head high, proud to be my brother's sister. I kissed and caressed my dead brother, and then I told them they had shot the best man in the world. As I am a Christian, I raised my eyes to heaven and had the strength to say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Since the return of democracy to Spain, Lluís Companys has become an iconic figure for Catalan nationalists. The Olympic Stadium in Barcelona, on Montjuïc Hill, is named after him, as are many streets across the region. And as Catalans continue their troubled relationship with Madrid, Lluís Companys' legacy is being discussed and debated more than ever before.
That was the BBC's Simon Watts. His story was produced for the BBC History podcast, Witness. And stay tuned for music from Catalonia later on the show. News headlines are next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Turkish man living in San Francisco has a dream to return to Istanbul and kayak across the Bosphorus Strait. His blindness is not an obstacle.
And there was this blind king called Phineas. His mission was guiding sailors in the dark safely to Black Sea from Mediterranean.
That story is still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You know something's fishy when rich people get arrested, but they don't go to jail, like those princes and elite officials who were detained, allegedly for corruption, in Saudi Arabia. They're being held at a 5-star hotel. But since the Saudi kingdom is such a mysterious place, we're not sure what it means or how it's connected to this.
The Houthis said that they lobbed a missile towards Riyadh's main international airport. The Saudi-led coalition said it intercepted the missile. And then in response to the attack, they closed off all entry points to Yemen, land, sea, air. Nothing was going in or out.
More on that mysterious missile in a moment. First, back to those arrests. Robert Worth covers the Middle East for The New York Times. So the Ritz-Carlton, Trump has stayed there. Obama has stayed there. Have you been there?
Yes, I have, only briefly.
And at this point, would you say it's fair to call this hotel the most luxurious prison on earth?
I think that's fair enough, yes.
I mean, it is pretty wild, as I read some of the reports, how this all happened, because there were guests there, right, with reservations who were already booked into the hotel.
Yeah, exactly. And my understanding is that people were essentially kicked out the way that they used to kick people out of a restaurant in Little Italy in New York when the mob decided to have a meeting there.
So you've spent some time in Saudi Arabia. If a 5-star hotel is suddenly turned into a prison, what does this say to Saudis who are looking from the outside in?
Well, I think a lot of people are actually quite excited about Mohammed bin Salman, and so they're willing to give him some latitude on this. On the one hand, sure, there's concern in Saudi Arabia and outside by the fact that there's no legal basis for these arrests. On the other hand, people know that what Mohammed bin Salman essentially wants to do is liberalize his economy. It's very, very ambitious ideas about how to do that economically and socially. And he thinks that to do that, he needs all the levers of power. So he's preemptively arresting all these people to cut off potential challengers.
Right. And just a reminder that Mohammed bin Salman is the crown prince and is basically on track to become king of Saudi Arabia. I mean, all of this leaves a lot to the imagination. I was looking at the Ritz-Carlton Riyadh website. They've got a fancy bowling alley, really a lot of dining options, not to mention the rooms. Do you have any details on what life is like for these detainees right now?
I really don't. I mean, one can imagine, you know, that it's very much a golden cage. I mean, I don't think they're making anybody feel uncomfortable. The real question is, who is talking to them and what are they saying? You know, one of the things that many, many ordinary Saudis will complain about is that you have a kind of a two-tier system of citizenship there, where if you are a royal or you're connected to the royals, you have sweetheart deals of all different kinds. And ordinary people don't have that kind of access. What the Mohammed bin Salman, who is, you know, de facto king of Saudi Arabia at this point, has in mind is to disenfranchise at some point large parts of the royal family to get back to a system that's much more like what you have in the other Gulf states like the Emirates.
I mean, there are interrogations going on of these detainees. Do you have any sense at all what they might be getting asked? And do you really believe this is ultimately about corruption, cracking down on corruption?
No, I think corruption is a convenient pretext here. I think most people believe that this is ultimately about consolidation of power. Certainly, you know, corruption goes on within that set, but corruption is a charge that can be laid at the feet of almost everybody in that high position in that country, a corruption of some kind or other. I think the real question is, to what extent will these people continue to play a role and under what kinds of rules? And that's where this gets risky. You know, at some point, he's going to have to let them out of the Ritz-Carlton. They can't
Mohammed
spend the
rest of their life. Yeah.
Exactly. They're going to have to be released. And then what will happen to them? You know, we can't really keep them all under house arrest. How are you going to cut back considerably on these people's power and potentially also expropriate a lot of their money, particularly in the case of Al-Walid bin Talal, the billionaire, who is the best known of those people, who is at the Ritz-Carlton now, who, you know, is known for his ownership and stakes in Twitter and other big companies. What's his life going to be like going forward? Nobody knows.
Why would Saudi Arabia essentially arrest people on sort of this corruption crackdown and then hold them in a fancy hotel? If you want to send a message to allegedly corrupt people, why not throw them in jail?
So corruption is a pretext here for an effort to change the entire system. What exactly are they going to do to change that system, and how quickly are they going to change it? Nobody has the answers to these questions. One of the most interesting questions now revolving about all this is that very recently, Jared Kushner was in Riyadh, apparently talking with Mohammed bin Salman until 4 in the morning, according to a column by David Ignatius in the Washington Post. What were they talking about? You know, was Kushner part of the plans to make this all happen? After all, we have to remember that this is only the domestic side of the equation we're talking about. At the same time, the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman in particular, have ideas for changing its foreign relations. And particularly, he's taking a much more aggressive line on Iran. You have to assume that that's also part of what he was discussing late at night with Kushner. And we don't know where that's going to lead.
Robert Wirth, The New York Times. Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure.
In 2015, Mohammed bin Salman, before he was the crown prince, his very first job for the kingdom, Saudi Minister of Defense, and his first military mission was to be a lightning-quick operation in neighboring Yemen. The objective was to root out a group of Shia rebels who had taken over the country with the help of, and this next part is really important, with the help of Iran. 32 months later, Saudi Arabia is still trying to root out the rebels. They're known as the Houthis. And this past weekend, the Houthis lobbed a missile all the way to the Saudi capital. Here to explain what that missile strike is all about is Christine Beckerle of Human Rights Watch. So tell us what happened on Saturday exactly, if you would, Christine.
So what happened was the Houthis said that they lobbed a missile, basically, as you said, towards Riyadh, towards Riyadh's main international airport. Now, the problem with that is directly or trying to target a civilian target, as the airport is likely a war crime. But what happened afterwards was the Saudi-led coalition said it intercepted the missile, that there were no casualties reported. And then in response to the attack, they closed off all entry points to Yemen. So that means land, sea, air, nothing was going in or out. And the reason this is problematic is as the war has continued since 2015, the humanitarian crisis has also devolved further and further and further. And part of the reason are previous coalition restrictions on the entry of aid and the movement of people and goods. And so the movement over the weekend, the retaliation by the coalition for the Houthi missile attack is very likely to have an extremely disproportionate impact on Yemeni civilians, which would also be in violation of the laws of war.
Now, the Saudis are calling this missile an Iranian missile. Was the missile made by Iran? What is the connection between the missile and Iran?
So we've heard Saudi claims for, you know, more than 2 years about the Iranians smuggling weapons to the Houthis and the Houthis, according to the Saudis, being Iranian proxies. But I think the jury's basically still out on how much support Iran is or is not giving to the Houthis. In terms of the missile itself, all we know is what the Houthis said it was and what the Saudis then say they determined based upon what they say were remnants that they examined inside Saudi. So Saudi says, okay, this is an Iranian missile. Then the Iranians and the Houthis both deny that fact. And we also know that before the war and that the Houthis are heavily armed because they were able to seize stockpiles from the Yemeni army. So where this missile actually came from, whether or not Iran had any role in this attack is really a question mark. Now, we know that Iran has given some support to the Houthis, but that's a far cry from saying that the Houthis are Iranian proxies or that the Iranians are directly responsible for this latest attack.
Your organization, Human Rights Watch, says this is a possible war crime. Why?
Retaliation against civilians is prohibited, right? So it is true, yes, that the Saudi-led coalition has carried out scores of unlawful attacks on Yemen, including killing many, many Yemeni civilians. But that does not justify the Houthis launching a missile at a civilian target in Saudi and endangering Saudi civilian lives.
And Christine, finally, we were just talking on the show about the Saudi princes and business leaders in detention at the Ritz-Carlton Riyadh. Do you see a connection between the missile launched at Riyadh and this alleged corruption crackdown in the kingdom?
I think basically the connection that's pretty clear is Mohammed bin Salman, right? So Mohammed bin Salman has been consolidating power in Saudi at a rapid rate. What he's also done sort of in addition to his pretty big internal moves is these, in what I would consider in some cases, reckless foreign policy moves, where you have this kind of belligerent language about Iran or Lebanon or Yemen or the Houthis or whoever it is tied to these sort of big internal domestic shakeups. But the kind of linking factor between both the domestic policies and the foreign policy decisions from Yemen to Qatar is this absolute failure to factor in or potentially to really care about what those policies mean for civilians, be they Saudi civilians or Yemeni civilians. And so I'm watching what's going on in the region over the last couple of days with extreme alarm, because we've seen already these moves, if you just look at Yemen, that have had, you know, devastating impacts. And you haven't seen a pushback from countries like the US or the UK. And so after this weekend, you have Donald Trump tweeting that he's, you know, supporting the Crown Prince and King Salman in terms of their latest moves internally in Saudi. And I'm sitting here wondering when, if ever, the US or the UK are going to come out and say something along the lines of, we're very concerned about the recent attacks on Yemeni civilians by coalition airstrikes, or we're very concerned that the Saudi-led coalition is likely going to severely worsen the humanitarian crisis by closing off all access to Yemen. But instead, what we see is sort of blind support for Mohammed bin Salman's domestic and foreign policy decisions. And what that has meant is that the impact that they have had on civilians have not only continued, but gotten worse.
Christine Beckerle of Human Rights Watch, thanks very much for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you.
Sunday's mass shooting in Sutherland Springs, Texas, has us back in a sadly familiar place as a country, asking ourselves why America has so many mass shootings when other nations do not. Simple answer, lots of guns. But we're also asking, more importantly perhaps, what can we do to prevent these shootings? One man who's really been thinking about this for a long time is Gary Slutkin. He's a doctor from Chicago who ended up working in Somalia. When he came back to the States after 10 years, he started learning about gun violence in American cities. And it reminded him of epidemics he's seen elsewhere, like cholera or TB.
When you look at a map, for example, Chicago or Los Angeles or even Iraq, you will see that in certain places on the map, the amount of this event, whether it is cholera or whether it is violence, seems to be very dense in a center, and then less dense, and then less, and then less. We call these epicenters. This is standard infectious disease epidemiology.
Gary Slutkin decided to treat gun violence like any other public health epidemic. He went to communities in cities like Chicago and Baltimore and showed workers how to identify people who might commit a shooting, someone with a grudge, for example. And then he trained the workers to calm those people down and de-escalate. Now those workers are known as interrupters. Slutkin says that same approach can be used to prevent mass shootings, too. I asked him to explain how, though, given that mass shootings are more isolated and sporadic than other kinds of violence.
Well, I mean, this is also one of the specialties of health and public health is we're able to look for rare events as well. And that's because there's methods for understanding the community or communities. In this case, social media is certainly part of it. But getting information from the community as to what's going on is highly relevant. And, you know, for these mass shooting behaviors that have occurred, you know, either teachers were aware of something, or in this case, you know, the military was aware of something, as was his family, as were neighbors.
It doesn't seem to be the case, though, like with the Vegas shooting.
Well, I don't know whether there was or not. And, you know, you can be less than 100% too. But I would be surprised if there weren't signs, because there's been signs in almost all of these. Mm. But you see, in these situations, the people who see these things, their choices are either to call law enforcement or do nothing for a friend of theirs or for their brother or for their son. And the results of that have usually been to do nothing or just to follow somebody. Like, for example, the person who did the shoot up in Orlando, he was actually followed by law enforcement for many, many months, but nothing was done to assist him to reduce the behavior. So since no behavior actually happened, it's like watching tuberculosis develop without treating it.
Mm. Isn't it a gargantuan task or proposition to say, you know, we can get rid of mass shooting if we intervene with everybody who felt marginalized?
Well, it isn't one-on-one with everybody, but there are these warning signs. There are communities that are at higher risk, and there are opportunities for people to be made aware that there are places they can call, and social media can be combed.
I mean, there are some Americans out there, as you know, who are just so frustrated and desperate for any solution right now. It's like, fine, let's call it an epidemic health issue. But by calling it an epidemic health issue, are you worried that people will not see it as a gun control issue?
I don't think we're going to dissuade anybody who's looking at it in that way. And there's relevance to that. But what I'm saying is that while this debate, while this political action is going on, we're able to reduce violence. I should just say, by comparison, you know, we were trying to get rid of the mosquitoes in Africa to reduce malaria, and we did. It turned out not to be feasible. We're now reducing malaria very, very rapidly by interrupting transmission by bed nets, by impregnated bed nets. So we're able to add another strategy. There's more than one way to resolve any epidemic problem.
Gary Slutkin is an epidemiologist at the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health and the founder of Cure Violence. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The Turkish city of Istanbul has two physical sides, one in Europe, the other in Asia, and in between the Bosphorus Strait, one of the busiest shipping channels in the world. We're going to hear a story now about a Turkish man who dreams of returning to Istanbul to kayak across that busy body of water. And as you're about to hear from Laura Clivens of station KQED, he's got one added challenge.
Ahmet Ustanel has been blind since he was 3 years old, when he lost his sight from eye cancer. He grew up in Istanbul, next to the Bosphorus Strait.
And I used to think that, you know, one day this strait, Bosphorus, should be more accessible to blind swimmers, blind surfers, or sailors.
Maybe he thought he could be that blind person navigating the Bosphorus. After all, there was a Greek myth about it.
There was this blind king called Phineas, and he used to live on the north side of the Bosphorus. His mission was guiding sailors in the dark safely to Black Sea from Mediterranean. So I thought, wow, you know, this guy is cool, so we should continue this tradition. So.
Years later, at 37, Ustinel hasn't given up on this dream. Now he lives in San Francisco. He moved to the U.S. to be with his wife. Last spring, Ustinel won the Holman Prize for Blind Ambition. That's $25,000 for blind or visually impaired adventurers. It helped him buy the right kayak and instruments needed to cross the Bosphorus solo. So how do you kayak if you can't see? First, use your other senses. Ustinel says they're full of information.
The direction of the current, smell of the land, plants or flowers, people, construction sounds, cars, the wind.
To cross the Bosphorus, Ustinel will kayak just 3 miles, but the strait is busy. The waters are crowded with huge freighters and tankers alongside small ferries and fishing boats, and the currents are strong. So Ustinel needs gadgets that tell him exactly where he is and what's around him. Today, he's launching off into a small lake in San Francisco. He rolls a suitcase to the dock, and inside, there's a black and yellow inflatable kayak. Ustinel takes his white and red cane and sticks it on the back like a flagpole.
Yeah.
What do you want it to say? Like, what? Why put this out?
So, don't run me over.
Is it also a pride, or is it mostly just
Yeah, for sure. You know, I'm a blind guy kayaking. You know, raising awareness, also, you know, symbolic thing.
Life jacket, check. Water shoes, check. Backup cell phone batteries, check.
Okay, so now I'm in. Let me see.
He pushes off and pulls out his smartphone. It's set to play at double speed for maximum efficiency.
Speed 0.6 kilometers, 245 degrees southwest, 246 degrees southwest.
Okay, so I'm going to head south. So I will take the street on my right and keep going south.
One GPS is on his phone. The other is attached to his kayak and beeps slowly if Ustinel is on track. And faster if he's drifting. His kayak is powered by foot pedals. That keeps its hands free to work all his devices. There's a sonar that fishermen use to find fish. Ustinel uses it to scan the water. When he's really in a pinch, Ustinel opens an app that connects him to a sighted person, a volunteer who could be anywhere in the world, who looks through the camera on his phone and sees for him.
Creating request.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi. I am on a kayak on a lake. I hear a street on my right. Can you see the street?
No, but that might just be the contrast. It's very dark.
It's very dark?
Just because the lake and the sky are so bright.
Okay.
There appear to be something moving there that might be cars.
Okay. And
the tools he's using are prototypes. Ustinel's testing them to create a more accessible world for nautical blind people. It's the kind of advocacy he does in his day job, too. He teaches visually impaired students at San Francisco Public Schools, partly because he struggled to find blind role models when he was a kid. One of his was even a mythological king. These days, though, human heroes are easier to spot. They might just be kayaking on a nearby lake. For The World, Laura Clivens, San Francisco.
Wishing him great luck. Check out Ahmet Ustinel in action at the helm of his kayak. We have video at PRI.org. An independence movement may seem to be the perfect trigger for a great song. It's bound to be energetic and optimistic and ought to have all sorts of emblems of identity of the people seeking independence. Take one band called Charango from Catalonia. They make it look easy.
Hauran pogut reculli l'aire al seu pas. Recorre el món i senti el cel a l'abast. Hauran pogut viure el que havíem somiat. Sense res més que una guitarra entre les mans.
Pure Catalan music in the Catalan language. Charango, make it sound and look easy. The independence question touches everything in the region as Catalan separatist leaders continue to make the case for independence from Spain. The Spanish government continues to oppose it. For a Catalan musician like Charango's lead singer, Alguer Miquel Bo, it's a bit of a dilemma. He wants to be part of the movement, but he doesn't want to be typecast.
I am a lot more things than a musician or a Catalan, yes. No, que dic que no em sento identificat com a músic, que la música només és una eina...
Music, he explains, in Catalan, just happens to be the way he and the band have chosen to try and connect with people. Lucky for the people that Charango's music is pretty good.
Recordarem mil carreteres plegats, la lluna roja i les sirenes del mar, els gratacels de les més grises ciutats i les estrelles sobre el riu, el cor de la casa amb mans. I a poc ens hem fet grans. Hi ha nits que encara ens pesen, però no han deixat de caminar. Que tot et vagi bé.
Alguel Miquel Bo says he and his bandmates in Charango are feeling frustrated about the current situation in Spain, but also just generally. He's got two main gripes.
Una és que els homes no cuidem el planeta on hem nascut, i l'altra és que no ens cuidem els uns als altres.
One, he says, is that we're not taking care of the planet, and the other, he says, we're not taking care of each other. And I'm guessing you don't have to be from Catalonia to get where he's coming from.
Vine'm a buscar, vine a robar-me l'aire, vine aquí, balla amb mi.
Here's one more song from Charango's album El Cor de la Tierra from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.